NamNab is a podcast that deals with the grisly details of a variety of topics, including true crime cases, government cover-ups, conspiracies, and the paranormal. This content is not suitable for everyone. Viewer discretion is advised.
She was murdered.
Summer dudes,
welcome back.
This is not a monster, not a boogeyman.
I'm Naomi.
I'm Janae.
And I'm Les.
And today we're continuing our series of terribleness.
Yes, and we have another special guest. Well, it's the same guest, just another time.
Hello, hello, hello.
Naya is back.
Naya in the house.
Hanging out with us, talking about this horrible shit. So if you haven't already listened to Johnny Gosh and Boys Town, I highly recommend that you go back and listen to those because they will play into what we're discussing today. I would say loosely with Johnny Gosh and then more solidly with Boys Town, but I recommend going back through all of it because we do talk about how it connects here. So, yeah, go back and check those out.
Yeah, I would say, like, this is, like, if you were to follow a web, this is the center.
Yes.
Right? Of this is the pinnacle.
Yeah.
And what we've been building up to literally this whole season, so.
With that said, let's just kind of jump in. Sources will be listed on the website. I'll go through a few of the, like, largest ones here. So, The Franklin Cover-Up by John DeCamp. It's a book. It's written by a Republican politician who was in Nebraska at the time, and that is where a lot of the material comes from. The Conspiracy of Silence documentary, which Naomi discussed in Boys Town as well, I kind of used some of that, and that documentary was banned in the U.S. I don't know if we talked about that.
Yeah, we did.
Okay.
Yeah. Good luck finding it.
Yeah.
It took me a minute.
And if you do, it's going to be either a transcript or YouTube, and it's fucked up.
Oh, like, it's all in parts.
It's bad.
It's old YouTube.
Last podcast on the left did a great series on this, and then I also used a book called Rabbit Hole by David Schurter to talk about how this kind of abuse impacts victims, and that specifically we get more into that piece at the end. Because I think that part is honestly left out of this conversation a lot. We focus a lot on what happened and not a lot on how these people work through and heal some of these issues. So today's episode is a continuation of a case that we discussed before. Of course, the disappearance of Johnny Gosh and then Boys Town. The story is connected to a larger conspiracy that is often connected through the disappearance of 12-year-old paperboy Johnny Gosh and the disappearances of other children at the time. A very heavy content warning this week, and I don't say this lightly, as we have said this entire time. These content warnings aren't light. They get really heavy, and this is kind of the antithesis of that. If you've already struggled through Johnny Gosh and Boys Town, this is not going to be something you want to finish out. It just gets worse from there. And as someone with experiences as a survivor of childhood sexual violence, this was really hard to get through and listen to. So if those are experiences that you have, I just remind you to be cautious of this kind of material and really check in with yourself and make sure you're okay. Not saying not to engage in it. It's important stuff, but if it's going to be emotionally damaging, please don't engage in this series or this episode. We will be discussing pedophilia heavily through the rest of this series, as well as the torture and murder of children and infants, drug use, cannibalism, anti-Semitic rhetoric, and abuse of power. Again, I remind you, like, I can't unread some of the things I had to read for this case, and they will go on with me for the rest of my life. So we're going to do our best to not get into the nitty-gritty, really disgusting details of this case because it's just not necessary. You can get the gist without us doing that. I want to state two things before we get started, too. Satanism in this case is, like, really poorly discussed. And that
always is.
Yeah, this is, like, a symptom of satanic panic, which we've talked about before.
Oh, yeah.
It's not... This isn't real Satanism.
No.
So just keep that in mind. Take it all with a grain of salt. And then all the things discussed here in this episode, this series, about the Franklin cover-up will be discussed as alleged. I'm prefacing all of this with that. That is not to say we don't believe these people or anything like that. That is just to say that we don't want to get sued. That's it. Legally, no one was ever found responsible for the allegations made in the Franklin cover-up, so we have to go on that basis. So in this part, we're going to kind of talk about what was told to the general public, and then we'll dive further into those allegations. So
to, like, most of America, that's who Larry King is.
Right. This, mm-hmm. like, it's like a financial crime. Mm-hmm. He's like an embezzler, right?
Yeah.
Which is a bad thing to be.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I find it really hard to believe that this is just financial based on the stories of these people. And that is how I feel, and that is how I will go through this case. First, I'll talk to you about John DeCamp. So John DeCamp wrote the book that a lot of my research is based off of. He is amazing. John DeCamp was an amazing man. He was a member of the Nebraska Senate from 1971 to 1987, and he was a Republican. After serving, he turned his efforts towards working as an attorney, which would come in handy later when he writes his book. He was a veteran of the Vietnam War and unfortunately passed away due to health problems in 2017. The work he did lives on through his novel and his advocacy for children, specifically working with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, specifically with Noreen Gosh, which we talked about a little bit. And he worked with survivors of horrific abuse, like Paul. DeCamp was also the attorney for famous whistleblower Paul Bernanke. So, yeah, he was his attorney through all of this stuff with...
Thank God for both of them.
All of that. Yeah, honestly.
Where would we be without them both?
So let's talk about the financial aspect of this, kind of what America knows about it. We'll talk about Larry King. And then we'll dive a little bit further. So the Franklin Community Credit Union was a financial institution that served the community of Omaha, Nebraska. Led by Lawrence King, a black Republican and businessman beginning in 1970, the credit union was responsible for supporting most of this community. From the beginning, federal officials had doubts about the credit union's ability to remain financially sound, but many politicians in Nebraska vouched for Larry King and his business sense. Nothing could go wrong, right? Wrong. According to a 1990 article in the Washington Post by Rick Atkinson, King was making a salary of $16,200 as the manager of this credit union. Yet, he drove a very expensive Mercedes, owned a 26-acre, four-story mansion, and spent $146,000 on flowers alone in just a year's time. Where did he get all of this money?
How much money are we talking?
We are talking, when we get to kind of the end of this, we're talking in total about $40 million.
What the fuck?
This is a large financial crime.
It's like more than we fund for schools.
Honestly. Yeah. Well, it's believed that King was committing fraud through the Franklin Credit Union, and it's believed that others within the company knew it. King was accused of nearly $40 million of fraud from the credit union in the time that he ran it, mostly to support his high-end lifestyle through fraud and embezzlement. King was not the only member of the company using funds to support their lifestyle. When people asked about his extravagant lifestyle, King stated that he and his wife received an inheritance from her family, which was a flat-out lie.
Oh.
When confronted about how he received the money, King cried racism, essentially claiming that people didn't believe he could have this much money because he was black. I want to point out that there's a very valid point to be made about racism and money and those kinds of things. That is not what's happening here.
Yeah.
This man was a piece of garbage, okay? Regardless of anything else.
That is so far off the table unless you're talking about it in the victim's context in this moment. That's it.
Exactly. And all of this evidence pretty much just leads to him being a shitty person. This isn't This isn't racism by the system, which is something that consistently happens to people. That's not fake. This is not what happened to this man. The credit union was shut down after it was raided in 1988, but does it end there? And why would he need that much money?
That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
I'm just like, what other endeavors was he in? You know, besides the obvious that we know.
Mm-hmm. We'll get there. We'll talk about it. So next, we've talked about some of the stuff here, but I want to go over it again in case you haven't listened to the Boys Town episodes. Episode? I don't remember. Anyway, Boys Town was started as an orphanage in 1917, which we've discussed, by members of the Catholic Church. A nationally recognized institution for helping children. No one thought this conspiracy, anything like this conspiracy, would come up. This charity began to serve the needs of the abused, neglected, and abandoned children. And that's kind of been its mission since the beginning, which we've talked about last time. Having nearly $500 million in reserves in the late 80s, Boys Town had a lot of money. And about a third of which comes from donation and, like, marketing efforts. That's a lot of money. Even a third of that is a lot of money.
Holy shit.
Who's all donating? Right?
Right.
Like, who is this? Or these people?
Who are these people?
Mm-hmm. Like, it is incredibly difficult to fund actual nonprofits.
Yes.
Just saying.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Not only are they incredibly well-funded, but they've been granted the privileges of many other organizations. And Naomi discussed this before, but they had the privileges of a small unincorporated town, a school district, and a Catholic diocese.
Hmm.
So they had a lot of power in this small area,
mm-hmm.
because of how much money they have invested in this small area and how much money that brings in to these people's area. With Larry King's involvement in the organization, allegations of abuse ran rampant through the late 80s and early 90s. King was well known for attending charity parties at both Boys Town and the Omaha Girls Club, which offered similar services to Boys Town. Many believed this to be because of the charitable giving he often did at the expense of the Franklin Credit Union. Larry King was on the board of directors for the Omaha Girls Club and gave a lot of money to Boys Town. A lot of money.
Yeah, big money.
Yikes.
And one can only wonder why. Boys Town kept much of their money at the Franklin Credit Union. The Boys Town account was one of the most important accounts that the Franklin Credit Union held. When the staff of Boys Town were asked to describe Larry King, they gave interesting accounts of the man that many believed to be charitable in doing great things for North Omaha. These accounts included King having a short temper, being, quote, dirty under the facade he put on, and stating that he took an interest in young men. This event led to an internal investigation within Boys Town, where none of the survivors wanted to discuss their experiences. Because of this, no incidents were ever reported to the authorities by anyone at Boys Town, despite the weird feelings and parties King gave to those familiar with him. The first time anyone in CPS or law enforcement heard of anything related to the abuse at Boys Town wouldn't come until 1986, despite evidence that it had been going on for at least 2 years prior.
And, like, these aren't small acts either. These are really big things.
Yeah. Yeah, these are big, big allegations, right?
Yeah.
So CPS actually got involved as early as 1985, three years before the Franklin cover-up was public information. So Child Protection received a call from a CPS caseworker who was working with a foster family, the Webbs. Jarrett Webb, the father, was a member of the board at the Franklin Community Credit Union, and his wife, Barbara Webb, was the cousin of none other than Larry King.
Mm.
Hmm.
The call reported intense abuse. There were up to 9 kids in this foster home, either adopted or foster children at any given time. That's
Did they have
kids.
Their own kids, too?
Yeah, Jesus. And we'll kind of talk about that.
That's a lot.
It's a lot of kids. For reports of sexual abuse in the home at the hands of Jarrett Webb, to at least one of the young girls in the home, And instead of facing the music and conducting an investigation, CPS removed the children from the home, and the Webbs immediately began terminating their rights as adoptive parents. Ugh. I want to point out that this is not like just going and giving your kids back to foster care. If you've adopted your children, this is literally like terminating your parental rights. That's essentially the step they took with these kids that they had already adopted.
So the kids just went back into the system? Oh my God.
It's fucking wild to me that they are treating these children like items when the adoption process is not... It's not you're not buying a pet, and even then you shouldn't treat your pets that way. These are human beings that are people, and you can't just treat them like fun little items that you're buying.
Thank you for saying that, because really everyone always focuses on the people who do these crimes instead of who they actually affected. That must have been terrifying for those kids after they were already damaged and without prosecution to the person who hurt them. What the fuck? Like, why are we giving kids to people who are terrible?
Because we're not vetting.
We don't believe kids. That's why. Because we're idiots. Yeah.
After refusing to file these charges, prosecutor Patrick Tripp quit his job as an attorney for the court.
Thank God.
And the Webb's involvement with King was much more sinister than just a family tie. Often, the Webb children were invited to the parties King attended and expected to show up alone and against their will.
No.
No.
These parties were attended by King, but also by the Webbs, sometimes as well, according to their children. These parties largely consisted of, quote, 25 young teenage girls and 10 to 15 older men, end quote.
What?
These weren't the only parties hosted by King. He loved to host large and elaborate parties, some of which were at his own home.
These wouldn't be like political parties sometimes, too.
Well, we'll talk about it. Oh. We'll talk about it. We'll get there. And these parties also included sex workers that were aged between 16 and 22. I hesitate to say sex worker when I say under 18. And around 20 additional children. So, like,
Jesus. Why were they sex workers? Did he really target people?
A child can't be a sex worker.
Is that what they
said? Is that what he labeled them?
Can we go there? Can we go there? A child can't be a sex worker.
No.
There's no consent. So some of the people he hired were actual sex workers, right?
Okay, that's what I was
wondering. Actual sex workers over the age of 18. But when they say quote-unquote sex worker, and we're talking about under the age of 18, these aren't sex workers. These are people forced into situations that they didn't consent to and are unable to consent to. Exactly. These are victims.
That sex is literally part of their abuse, being at that party.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So, like I said, you know, sex workers aged between 16 and 22 and around 20 children aside from that. So if men were interested in someone, they would hand them $50 to $100 and then leave the room, essentially. King claims that these parties were nothing out of the ordinary, but according to the Webb children, these parties were simply for sex and orgies. I want to remind folks that this is all alleged.
Right. Oh, of course.
Sure, I allegedly fucking feel sick to my stomach.
Oh, allegedly. Allegedly, I'm fucking disgusted. Some of the guests at these parties included local school officials from the nearby school district, school administrator Deward Finch, and local high school principal Kent Miller.
What the fuck?
Turns out both of these men were friends of prosecutor Pat Tripp. The two daughters who came forward with this information also discussed how they often saw the Webb parents called into Principal Miller's office by Deward Finch, and sometimes by Miller himself. Barbara Webb That's often weird. Attended these meetings and brought sealed envelopes filled with photos to them.
No.
These were the photos from the closet in the Webb house that the children were told to stay away from, full of photos of potential child pornography, Ugh. And dirty magazines. The Webb children discussed how they were afraid of King, how he had a quote, bad temper, and, quote, might hit you. The primary survivor in this case gave so much information that could have and should have led to investigations about this information years before the public had its eyes on Franklin and the Franklin cover-up, and Omaha, Nebraska. This included one party in Washington, D.C. The survivor states that she remembers seeing lots of gay sexual encounters between older and younger men in their 20s, so sex workers at these parties. These parties were top secret. Every guest had to be invited. Many of them had bodyguards with them at all times, and a card was required to verify the identity of the guest. Each guest was frisked before they entered the building.
This is top notch. Like, yeah, this is not private, no private, fucking private. Little house party. VIP, Jesus Christ.
And obviously they're worried about, like, the importance of the people there because they're being frisked. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There's bodyguards on bodyguards.
Everywhere. These parties continued up until it was made public information. All of the information was turned over to authorities in Omaha in 1986. Once questioned by police, the primary witness and survivor took 4 lie detector tests in total, and she passed every single one of them. Wow. The Webbs walked free, and King continued to gain power. This would not be the only time these abuses naming Larry King would come up, as many children in the foster system and otherwise would come forward to discuss and name King as a key person in their abuse. Authorities do just about nothing with this information, likely because of the powerful people in Omaha who were involved. The director of the foster care system at the time said she believes that these allegations were never properly handled by the investigative authorities. King continued to abuse his power to traumatize the children of the area. This whole thing is just going to piss you off. In May of 1988, more allegations against people in Omaha and their interactions with children would come up. Next up would be photographer Rusty Nelson.
Slimeball Nelson.
Rusty. And this name came up in Johnny Gosch, didn't it?
Yeah, it did.
Mm-hmm. You want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, if you didn't listen to that case, he basically was... Well, Johnny had been seen getting photographed probably like weeks before he actually was kidnapped. And Rusty Nelson was who was described as taking those pictures, yeah, by some other women who also were almost abducted by Nelson or actually part of his engagement child pornography.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, so according to the Franklin cover-up book, these reports were made by 17-year-old Brenda Parker and her mother, Margot. And these names that were listed in the Franklin cover-up are to conceal the identity of the actual people. So these names are made up. Rusty had approached Brenda in a store while she was shopping, where he chatted with her and then gave her his business card, which said, quote, Rusty Nelson, creative photographer and cameraman, end quote. Brenda called his number, and Rusty shared that he was working on a project that required him to photograph redheads like her. He then told her that she would be shot in swimsuits and lingerie, despite the fact that she was under the age of 18. Brenda decided to bring her mother to the shoot. Fantastic idea. 5 days after the shoot, Brenda and her mother would share the details of this, quote, photo shoot to Omaha police. Brenda shared that Nelson had taken photos of her in all kinds of clothes, but no lingerie or swimsuits. He kept making references to Brenda naked. He would try to get her to show as much skin as possible and as much cleavage as possible. When Nelson tried to get Brenda to wear lingerie, she refused. And during this, Brenda's mother, Margot, was looking through the photographs scattered around Nelson's apartment / studio in the Twin Towers apartments. Margot noticed that many nude photographs were of girls, many of them young. And Margot's best estimation of the age range was approximately 12 years old to up to 20 years old.
Gross.
Many of these photos were full frontal nudity.
Fucking gross. You're gross.
Because of these findings, Margot began calling the references Nelson had provided modeling agencies in a variety of schools in Omaha. However, no one had ever heard of him, with the exception of one person who had called Nelson a, quote, pervert. End quote. God. At this point, Margot went to the police. Nelson was described as 25 years old, 5'9", dirty blonde hair with a small blonde mustache, and he was about 140 pounds. Brenda reported the details of the conversation she had with Nelson during the five-hour photo shoot to the authorities. Brenda told police that she believed he was gay, as he had told her that he did work for the local gay bar in Omaha known as the Max, and that he frequented other gay bars in the area. Nelson mentioned being self-employed, but he also made many mentions to the, quote, boss. This included the boss allowing Nelson to live in the apartment / studio and keep it stocked. He never mentioned who his boss was. Anyone have any guesses?
Or what he was working with? Or
Larry who? King.
I was going to say.
Mr. Larry King.
Of course.
On May 25th, 1988, one of Omaha's finest went to the Twin Towers to investigate the situation and Rusty Nelson. Upon questioning the owner of the complex, he discovered that Rusty Nelson of Unit 3B had moved and that the apartment at the time that was occupied by Nelson was leased to none other than Mr. Larry King. Nelson moved on May 14th, just 9 days after Brenda and her mother filed the complaint with Omaha police. The complex owner had also mentioned that Larry King had paid rent on one of the most luxury penthouses in the building. The apartment had been rented in August of 1987, and the owner was sure to mention all the absurd expenses that he had witnessed go into the penthouse, around $50,000 of decor and furnishings, not including the original art owned and one solid silver chair that Larry King had brought in the building.
Solid silver.
In original art. Like, by original artists. That's typically a lot of money.
Yeah.
Five different vehicles, including a Mercedes, a Cadillac, and some type of sports car, and even paying to have a crane lift his couch into the penthouse because the elevator just wouldn't fit his couch. I would like to remind everybody that this is on a $16,200 salary.
Bullshit.
So in today's money, his salary from the credit union would have been about $38,000.
Still not, no.
That's nowhere near enough to have a fucking crane lift your
Mercedes.
Couch. Your wife's goose egg, Jesus Christ.
Right.
Also, who would be married to Larry King? I'm sorry. No offense. Just saying.
Sicko.
This lady who married Larry King, apparently. The owner of the Twin Towers apartments also stated that Larry King didn't live in the penthouse that he rented, just used it for parties sometimes and would sleep over kind of here and there.
Does no one notice all of these children going in and out of these
I don't think
places?
Anyone cares. The owner also mentioned discussing with a local realtor about how King had tried to purchase a home 5 years ago, but was unable to because he didn't have enough money to make the down payment. 5 years is not that much time.
No, it's not.
So, yeah. How was it possible for King to come up with that much money in just 5 years?
Doesn't add up.
It don't add up. The apartment complex next door, the Orpheum Tower, also had a tenant named Larry King. The person occupying the apartment, the DJ over at the downtown gay bar, the Max. At this point, the officer investigating had the same questions we do. Why does Larry King have an apartment rented across the street from two other rentals? Authorities discussed with the manager of the Orpheum Tower. She mentioned hearing rumors that Larry King was, quote, a heavy drug user. End quote. She mentioned also hearing that King was gay and he had a thing for young boys and men. Shortly after this little investigation, Omaha PD dropped the investigation of Nelson and his boss.
No.
Not ideal. On June 28th, 1988, Omaha police were sent out to interview a 15-year-old named Loretta Smith. At the time of this interview, Loretta was being held at a local hospital for psychiatric care. Her therapist called the police when Loretta shared, quote, being photographed nude and partially nude and being involved in devil worship, end quote.
What? What does she mean by that?
So Loretta shared that she had attended a party with friends who were older than her, and she was just 9 years old when she had attended this party. She was approached by a photographer, a white man, no other description, to take some pictures. She was talked into being photographed nude. She mentions that she had spent a lot of time at the North Omaha Girls Club with her friends, the Webb children, who we discussed earlier, mm-hmm. who had made severe allegations against Larry King. Right. The Webb children shared their experiences of being photographed nude and partially nude as well. She mentioned that many of the staff at the North Omaha Girls Club took nude photos of them, as well as big name doctors and lawyers from around town. Many of these prominent officials used code names at these sessions, so she was unable to provide legitimate names of the people who had done this kind of stuff to
her. Because you know what you are doing is wrong.
Illegal. Yeah. Literally.
You are disgusting. Mm.
She mentioned that these individuals had threatened her and other children involved with the violence if they did not keep quiet about the abuse. They even threatened to kill her family if she refused to participate. It gets worse. Loretta began to mention being involved in, quote, devil worship, end quote, and rituals at the age of 11. She mentioned that these sessions involved being given a drink at the beginning, the drug you were talking about. Loretta said she believed it was apple juice, but she thought it was laced. Everyone participating, the children specifically, were given this drink. This was the second time police would hear this information, as the Webb children provided this exact same information to police and nothing was done about it. Loretta shared this inside information, stating that she was friends with the daughter of the owner of the Max, the gay bar near King's multiple apartments in Omaha. She mentioned when visiting her friend, the father would get drunk and disclose interesting information, like Larry King's love for cocaine and his business running drugs through the streets of Nebraska through the use of connections, like Mr. Gary West. She also mentioned the home where King had had sex and drug parties, stating that she had been there once and witnessed 3 to 4 teen boys being used as sexual entertainment.
Ugh, no. God, Jesus. He also was involved in drugs. Like, I just want to point that out to you.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I don't know if this is common or has anything to do with it, but the whole satanic rituals, and I say that in quotations as well, like, why is that so highly affiliated to children getting abused? Like, I've heard that so many times.
A lot of that goes back to the origins of satanic panic.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah. They just use that to their benefit that Americans are
afraid of. Yeah, it's exactly. To put fear into situations also, and then make them seem unapproachable.
Exactly.
The reporting officer recommended taking time to remember these reports in detail. Loretta was informed that the police would still take on her report at a later date. Loretta called to give Officer Carmini the address and phone number for the King House where these parties allegedly took place. It would take time before Loretta began to trust her doctors and mental health workers at the hospital, and Loretta began sharing her horrible experiences with the medical staff at the hospital. These notes would later be used by the Franklin Committee as evidence of misconduct on those who had been accused. The hospital documented all that she had shared, including reports of, quote, witnessing the homicides of several young children, end quote. In these reports, Loretta was able to give a detailed and chronological account of events. Loretta agreed to this giving of a detailed and chronological account of events. We're going to get into some stuff that is very hard. So I want to warn you again, if this is a lot, please don't continue this series. It is hard and that is okay. And we'll continue to kind of discuss the implications of not only this for Loretta and the Webb children, but the children of Omaha in general, and how big this case kind of gets without actually serving any justice to anyone affected. So, but this is kind of your dip into the Franklin cover-up.
The giant web of lies.
If you want to see stuff about this case or the entire series that we've been doing, go to namnab.com and visit our blog. We'll have stuff from Johnny Gosch, Boys Town, and now Larry King. So that way you can kind of go through and follow along with what we've been talking about for a little while.
Also, if you want to see some pretty exclusive content, come hang out with us on Patreon. Some really cool stuff there that's, you know, worth it. Worth your time.
Come back next week, folks. We'll be talking about some interesting stuff. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.